Good evening, America. Welcome to the program. This is a Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. I'm Sam Thurman, along with Lisa Stewart and Cliff Stewart, with our special contributing analyst, Exoneree Lamont Banks. How's everyone doing?
Doing good.
Doing pretty good,
well.
Sam.
Our phone number this evening for our listeners is 347-838-8976, 347-838-8976. Got a good show lined up this evening. We're going to talk about children being sentenced to adult prisons, and so joining us to talk about that a little bit later will be Carmen Perez. She is the executive director of the Gathering for Justice, and then also Mark Clements. We've had Mark on the program before. Mark was wrongly convicted at the age of 16, and now he's working with the Northwestern Center for Wrongful Conviction. So they will be joining us a little bit later. We have a pre-recorded profile of the wrongful convicted that's going to be coming up a little bit later as well. So let's talk a little bit. Well, first, before I jump there, let's go to the disclaimer. We are not attorneys, and a Just Cause Coast to Coast does not provide legal advice. So please contact your personal legal advisor for any legal needs. Also, the opinions expressed by callers and guests do not necessarily reflect that of a Just Cause or a Just Cause Coast to Coast. But as always, thank you for tuning in and choosing to spend time with us this evening. Let's talk a little bit about the IRP 6. The IRP 6 are Gary Walker, David Banks, Dave Zerpolo, Kendrick Barnes, Clinton Stewart, and Demetrius Harper. You know, we have to bring that up because these gentlemen are our brothers, and they have been wrongly incarcerated for over 2 years now. Now, in the last week or so, we've been talking about attorney Gwendolyn Solomon, and she filed a petition for writ of certiorari. How do you say that, Lamont?
It's a writ of certiorari.
Thank you very much. So that's been filed with the U.S. Supreme Court. And so we are monitoring that situation and waiting to see what's going to come of that. And so, you know, we're excited about that. You know, as we talk about the fact that this case has made it that far because of the fact that, you know, through the all the way from the beginning, through the lower courts, through the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals, there have been several, I'll use the words that we've heard lately, inappropriate actions or irregularities that have occurred throughout this entire case. But at any rate, the points that were under appeal were Fifth Amendment violation, right to a speedy trial. You had the expert witnesses that were not allowed to testify. And then you also had a transcript that was missing. Now, on this transcript issue, this is where federal court judge Christian Arguello forced the guys to take the stand, therefore violating their Fifth Amendment right, but then the transcript pertaining to that just disappeared.
Yes, and you know, we've spoken a lot about the missing 200 pages of transcript, and that part that you talk about, Sam, that's the critical issue, is that during the sidebar where all of this activity took place, that is where this that is the piece that's missing. That is the piece that is nowhere to be found, that, you know, they basically tried to mask or cut and paste a part of the transcript. They tried to set up a timeline that shows about a minute, maybe two, of activity in the court proceedings, and an entire sidebar is missing from there. And what is really sick about the appellate court is that even when Judge Jackson, you know, queried everybody, the court reporter, Judge Arguello, and he makes a statement that nobody's even trying to contend that, you know, something's not there. Everybody admits, yes, there's something missing. There is a part of this, there is this conversation, this sidebar that does not appear in the transcript. So how then is it not missing? You know, they try to play semantics on words, and it's like, you still don't show where the judge violated the Fifth Amendment right, and then for the appellate attorneys to just step over that and never deal with it, and then to say, oh, no, Ken Barnes took the stand, you know, voluntarily, when Judge Arguello told him, if one of you guys don't take the stand, I'll close your case for you. So how do they just step over that? And that's just one of the issues. Like you said, Sam, that is a Fifth Amendment issue against, you know, having to testify as a defendant outside of your will to do so. They also have the Sixth Amendment, which is, you know, the violation or the right to present, you know, their evidence at trial, and, you know, which pertains to the expert witness as well, and the speedy trial. You have all of these issues that the Supreme Court looked at, and I mean, not the Supreme Court, the appellate judges looked at and glossed over, and then actually used their own judgment in one case where they overturned a case because of a speedy trial violation. They used that same verbiage, the same case law, the same everything to uphold this conviction. It makes absolutely no sense what they're doing. And so that's why it's being pushed to the Supreme Court.
And also, even on that, you talk about the assistant U.S. attorneys who were there, mm-hmm. and Judge H. Lee Sarakin, he had written a five-part series on Huffington Post about this case, and he even questioned, and Judge Jackson questioned, you know, why haven't the assistant U.S. attorneys stepped forward, Matthew Kirsch and Sunitha Hazra, mm-hmm. and provided an affidavit to say, okay, here's what I heard, or here's what I didn't hear at that sidebar conference. It's obviously their boss, the U.S. attorney in Denver, John Walsh, he hasn't made them step forward. And so it's just a gross injustice that has occurred
here. Right. And you know, on some of our trips to Washington, we've talked to some people in Congress saying, hey, you know, explain to us, you know, this situation. And when we break it down to them and say, yeah, they asked, they said, well, what did the assistant U.S. attorney that was prosecuting this case, what did they say? And we say, well, they haven't said anything. And they're saying, well, it's not their position. Their position is not to get a win. That is not what their job scope is. The scope of their job is to find justice in any court case, any case that they prosecute or whatever. They're supposed to find justice. And so they're saying that Matthew Kirsch, Sunitha Hazra absolutely need to step up to the plate and say, this is what we heard at the sidebar. And John Walsh, as their boss, as the U.S. attorney in Denver, Colorado, he needs to ensure that that happens. And since he has not, as of yet, that is why we're querying the U.S. Attorney General, Eric Holder, to get them to answer. What is going on up in Denver? What happened at this sidebar that mysteriously disappeared from the court transcript?
Now, you know, at one point during this case, and it started about a year ago, a Just Cause, as well as the families of the IRP6, and I'll put it this way, kind of called in reinforcements.
Mm-hmm.
And because we talked about it in the press release that was put out today, the mother of one of the IRP6 saw Mark Garagos on television and said, you know, hey, you know, this guy looks like he really cares about his cases, and, you know, let's see if we can reach out to him. So, you know, we reached out to him, came on board, and at first, you know, it looked like this was a situation where there was genuine interest in the case. Attorney Gwendolyn Solomon was already on the case, had been for over 2 years, or for about 2 years at that point. It's been over 2 years now, and she's been pro bono the whole time. Well, when we first approached Mr. Garagos in order to pursue the missing transcript, mm-hmm. you know, he said, well, yeah, I'll come on board. You know, we'll do it for a $50,000 retainer. And then in January time frame or so, the question came up as to, as new evidence becomes available, you know, what do you think about the idea of pursuing a motion for bond pending appeal? You know, let's get the guys out while we're going through this whole appellate process, while this thing with the transcript is being batted around, you know, all the things associated with that. Again, you know, Mr. Garagos said, well, no, I'm not going to recommend anybody for that. I'm not going to refer anybody for that. Let me take that as well. But it's going to be another $50,000. Well, we have since had to file a complaint with the California Bar Association, because the wheels just came off that wagon. I mean, when you think about representation, There was a lot lacking there. And so we ended up filing the complaint based on lack of communication and then failing to act competently. I mean, yes. those are statutes or clauses right out of the California Bar Association. Mm-hmm. And basically the bottom line is when we would reach out for communication to check on the status of the case, to you know try and set up a conference call, any of these things, we were, after a while, we're confronted with lack of communication. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I personally was on the receiving end of some serious verbal abuse. Yeah. I'll put it like that.
Everybody enjoys cussing you out, huh? Sam?
I guess so, man. It's like for the I get it quite a bit.
Well, I mean, you got that face.
I guess so. A face for radio.
It's like cuss me out. But I mean, when you look at the rules of the California Bar Association that deal with communication, and it's talking about how an attorney should communicate with their client, that anytime there's news that needs to be passed on to the client, and when the client reaches out and says, "Hey, you know, I have a question," you know, not just things that are saying, "Hey, you know, how's your day or whatever." We're talking about these are people's lives on the line.
This is
business. You're being paid to represent me, and when I have a question about my case, I should be able to get in touch with you, and we should have some communications. And every time, I don't think there was maybe once that we actually got a schedule that Mark Garrigou showed up on time, maybe once. But you know one of the weirdest ones, or I guess not weirdest, but the most obvious happenings or occasions of this is we're trying to get in touch with him, trying to find out what's going on with a filing of a motion after Judge Jackson said, "Hey, get this to me immediately." Some things that he wanted from the court. Go down to the courthouse, find what they have and tell me what's there and what's not there. And when we try to call him up saying, "Hey, we're on the conference call. We're waiting for you. Where are you at?" "Well, give me a few minutes." "Give him a few minutes. Give me 20 minutes. I'll be there." 20 minutes pass. "Hey, we're still here. We call back in. What's going on?" "Well, it's a good game going on, and I'm in the middle of it, so give me a little more time." That is just sickening. When you're talking about we have people spending time in prison and you're putting us off for a football game, I mean, these are the type of things when you say, "Yeah, absolutely, we have a complaint." You're getting paid to represent a client, and you're watching a football game. That's the reason you can't keep an appointment with us.
And, you know, Cliff, the thing, too, is, you know, it was several months before he even spoke to the IRP 6. And his very first conversation, and this is sad to say, it was a conference call. He never met them in person. The gentlemen were still incarcerated. They are still incarcerated. He set up a conference call and got on the call. And you know, based on the feedback that we've gotten from the IRP 6, is that he began to blast A Just Cause, blast me, blast Gwendolyn Solomon, but the worst of it is he blasted them. I mean, it's like, how are you going to yell at your clients?
Exactly.
And then, you know, you're supposed to be trying to have a conversation to establish or convey, okay, here's a strategy, and you know, what do you guys think about that, and to hear your clients out as well. And then you hang up on them, and then on top of that, you tell them you continue to chase your constitutional rights all you want to. You're going to end up spending all of your time in jail, and hang up on it. And that does not constitute, you know, professional courtesy, respect for your client. And I refer to this situation and how I've been spoken to is like, you know, you pay somebody to cuss you out. You pay you pay somebody to call you and hang up on you. I need a gig like that.
Oh, I'm telling you.
No, I don't.
Like for $100,000, what do I do?
Yeah, that's the worst. That is the worst.
Absolutely nothing.
And Cliff, and you know as well, and this is one of those things, too, that got me. He agreed to do the cases for a certain amount as far as retainer. And then at some point, he came back to us and said, well, a case like this, you would have spent, you know, 4, 5, 6 times that much by now.
It's like, yeah, but that's what you agreed to.
Exactly.
And furthermore, you have done absolutely nothing.
Exactly. So nothing. Why are you yelling at us and saying that this case would have already cost you $250,000, $300,000, $400,000?
And why? Because your name is on it?
Yeah.
That is just sick. It's like if the client pays for something, do it. And we aren't saying,
And why you got to throw that up in somebody's face anyway?
Yeah, it's like your rate is your rate, whatever it may be.
Yeah, and tell us what your rate is. Right, exactly. Let us make a decision. Okay, and, well, that's a little steep for us. We're not going to go that route. But once you put the rate on the table.
Once you put the rate on the table.
Why you got to come back and throw it in somebody's
exactly,
face?
Exactly. And you agree to
accept
that.
I'm starting to sweat now.
It's like, now it's time to do what you've been paid for. If that's what you agree to, anytime you have anybody do a job, say, this is a job I need to have done. This is how much we can come to agreement on what I'll pay, what you charge for. Everybody says yes. Okay, well, now get the job done. Don't say because you gave me a lower rate, now, okay, well, I'm not really going to do anything. Well, I could have went and found somebody else who would have agreed to the terms and actually got something done.
And then, you know, Gwendolyn Solomon, she did most of the work anyway.
Exactly.
I mean, she was doing the legwork. She was putting together the motions. She was doing a lot of the research. She would send it over to them for, you know, to bounce it off of them. She would make some suggestions on doing certain things certain way. He would come back and say, well, you guys need to do this. But, you know, to just disrespect the guys, disrespect their families, and then to make these comments about, you know, I ain't holding nobody's hand.
Right.
But then when you talk about the effects that this thing had on the families and the way he just disrespected that. You know, it's really disheartening when you see someone on television portraying themselves one way, but then in real life, they are totally different. Totally different.
Jekyll and Hyde.
So, anyway, let's do a quick call to action as far as the missing transcript. So, you know, we want to get the participation of the listening audience, get your families involved. Anyone out there who has not participated in this, you can get more information about the IRP 6 case. You can go to freetheirp6.org, freetheirp6.org. There's all kinds of information out there about the IRP 6, the case, the gentleman themselves. And then, but as far as the transcript, Lisa, I know we want to try and get our listeners to participate by contacting Eric Holder's office.
Yes, we want everybody who can to please reach out to Attorney General Eric Holder at 202-514-2003 or 2005 and request that he look into the missing transcript of the IRP 6 case and the injustice that's gone on in this case. We need somebody to investigate, and we need your help to do it.
And, you know, this is something that is definitely worthy of an investigation. I mean, there are too many, using the words again of Andrew Craig, too many irregularities.
Yes.
And this is something that people need to look into, even going back. And we don't want to even miss talking about the jury that was involved, Cliff.
Right.
And how, you know, there's questionable activity there as well.
That's right, because Judge Arguello gave them one set of instructions. You know, in open courts after the verdict, saying, hey, you know, we thank you for your service. You know, everything is over. You're free to talk to who you want to. And then she asked them to meet her in the back so that she could thank them personally. Well, you just thanked them personally in open court. But then she met them in private and told them if they were contacted by anybody from the defense team or the defendants, that, you know, to contact Assistant U.S. Attorney Matthew Kirsch, and he would take care of it. Well, we found out that, you know, in trying to contact some of the jurors that, yeah, that happened. They contacted Matthew Kirsch, and he had an FBI agent get in touch with a juror who told them that if anybody else from the defense team tried to contact you, let me know as an FBI agent, and I'll take care of it. Well, what does that mean, you know, that an FBI agent will take care of it? That could mean a lot of things. But basically, the jury was intimidated by these type of actions. So if the judge did things like that during the case and everything else that we talk about, not allowing expert witnesses, forcing a defendant to testify, then, you know, there's got to be other things on the table. Some of the things we have found out, we have information that you may not, as the jurors in this case, have. If you would like that information, reach out to us, and we'll give you everything that we have. Any information is free for you to have. We'll freely give it to you. Reach us at 855-529-4252. Again, that's 855-529-4252, or send us an email at contact@a-justcalls.com.
And we truly do appreciate you tuning in each week on Tuesdays and Thursdays from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time. You can catch archives of the program at ajcradio.com. You can also get 24/7 AJC programming at live365.com. We're going to take a quick break. Like us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. Our phone number this evening, if you'd like to dial in and participate in the conversation, is 347-838-8976. 347-838-8976. Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. Don't go anywhere.
When does it stop being partly cloudy and start being partly sunny? Why is the word abbreviation so long? Are English muffins just muffins in England? Why is it called a washing line and not a drying line? Do fish get thirsty? If ghosts can walk through doors, why don't they fall through floors? Do you yawn when you sleep? If prunes are dried plums, how do they make prune juice? Why do doctors leave the room when you change? They're going to see you naked anyway. Do bald chefs wear hairnets? How much deeper would the ocean be if all the sponges were taken out? Do you believe someone who says they're a chronic liar? Why is sandwich bread square and sandwich meat round? Life's full of hard questions. Ask one more. You might just save a life.
I'm Chase Crawford.
Hey, what's up? It's Usher.
Hi, I'm Rachel Bilson.
I'm Hayden Christensen.
I'm Peyton Manning.
Hey, we're Fall Out Boy.
I'm Jared Archuleta.
I'm Corbin Blue.
I'm Kristen Bell.
And we're the Jonas Brothers.
Do something good for your community.
Reuse bags and bottles and always recycle.
Help us collect 1 million pounds of food.
Help people prepare for natural disasters.
Do something about homelessness.
Anyone could be a rock star in their community.
So then do something.
Do something.
Do something.
Do something.
Visit dosomething.org to find out how.
Individuality.
I stand for peace.
I stand for diversity.
I stand for dignity.
I stand for respect.
I stand for fairness.
Red, yellow, black,
white. We're all the same color.
When you turn out the light.
What is going on here?
Together in one place.
What have we come to?
Harry Belafonte, Talib Kweli, Immortal Technique, Aja Monet, Cornel West, Jusiri X, Brian Stevenson, Central Park Five, Sophia Elijah, George Gresham, Linda Sarsour, and hundreds of others join the movement to end child incarceration. Growing Up Lockdown, Juvenile Justice Conference. For more information, go to gatheringforjustice.org.
The opinions and views expressed by guests and callers on A Just Cause Coast to Coast do not necessarily reflect those of A Just Cause or A Just Cause Coast to Coast.
Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. I'm Sam Thurman, along with Lisa Stewart, Cliff Stewart, and Lamont Banks. Let's jump back real quick. Let's talk about the IRP6, the software that they developed. They developed a software called Case Investigative Lifecycle Software. You know, we're coming up on the anniversary of 9/11. It's the 13th anniversary. And, you know, this software was designed to help local, state, and federal law enforcement from a standpoint of tracking and taking care of illegal activities.
That's right.
And tracking cases and that type of thing. So with the anniversary of 9/11 coming up, you know, it's important to raise this issue, especially with ISIS being in the news, mm-hmm. Al-Qaeda being in the news. And we do have a special show coming up on September 11th, this Thursday. So please mark your calendar so you can be sure to tune into that. But, you know, there was an article that was recently posted by Judicial Watch, and it was talking about military experts with ISIS in El Paso, Fort Bliss, in danger of terrorist attacks. So, you know, this article is talking about, you know, a potential attack on U.S. soil.
That's right, El Paso, Texas.
Yeah.
America.
And they're saying, you know, basically right there with that being a border town, that, you know, it's kind of a staging area for ISIS to come in and do an attack right there at Fort Bliss. And this kind of thing has people concerned because of the fact that you look at all the different reports that have come out, the 10th anniversary of the 9/11 Commission report that came out a couple of months ago, and the question that resounds over and over again is America safer than it was, you know, 13 years ago? And we've seen reports that say we're no safer than we were on September 10th, 2001. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when you read this kind of thing, and it makes people, you know, take note that when a military installation goes on alert, and they start, you know, beefing up the and taking extra precautions at their gates and so forth, then that's reason for, I think, everyone to take note that why are we still in this state? Mm-hmm. Why are we still in the situation that we're in?
Yeah, when you look at the statement that, you know, that the military first put out, this article about this ISIS in El Paso, Texas, says a statement that went out to the media was rather vague, attributing the move because they're moving people out of Fort Bliss and saying, okay, we have an imminent threat, we need to move them out. But first they said the statement that went out to the media, rather vague, attributing the move to several recent security assessments and the constant concern for safety of military families, members, employees, and civilians. But senior military officials contacted by Judicial Watch this week, which this was last week, revealed that military installations in the U.S. only make changes to security measures when there are clear and present threats. Quote, it's a significant issue when this is done, says retired Army Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin, former commander of the Army's Elite Delta Force, who also served 4 years as Deputy Undersecretary of Defense for Intelligence. That means they're getting a threat stream. Fort Bliss had to have a clear and present threat. So, you know, when you look at this, they're saying, hey, ISIS is in America. They're in El Paso, Texas. We know that there's a threat on Fort Bliss. And the Silk software that IRP Solutions created, you know, which the IRP6 are the executives of IRP Solutions, one of the main modules of the Silk software was the basically people tracking, the confidential informant, and also being able to track a person of interest. So you can see that if this software had been in place,
that it could help to attribute to tracking these ISIS sales to say, hey, this is where we saw this person, this is where we saw that person, this is you know, this is who they have contact with. These, you know, this software was made to bring together the information by the federal law enforcement. I mean, everybody under DHS, that you would have one set of data that says, hey, everything that the FBI knows, the CIA knows, and NSA and all of the other, you know, federal law enforcement agencies in a secure manner, so that, you know, nobody wants to say, okay, we'll just share the data and throw it out there so it's up in the air and anybody can get it. We know that that is a security concern as well. But to securely share this data across all these arms of law enforcement, that's what the Silk software was built to do. And at this, at the, with the present threat on U.S. soil, I mean, where's the Silk software? Sitting on a shelf, and where are the executives who built it? Sitting in federal prison, having been charged with mail fraud and wire fraud when it was a debt case. This is absolutely sick. And the most sickening part, it seems that, you know, the people who were involved, the Judge Arguello, U.S. Attorney Walsh, Assistant U.S. Attorney Kirsch, Sunitha Hazra, the court reporter, do they care about our national security? Do they care about the country on the whole, or is it to, for them, do they just want a win for the federal government? Is that what it's all about? It makes you sick to know that we're at threat, and the help against that threat is sitting locked up in prison for in the words of Attorney General Eric Holder, no good law enforcement reason.
And the country has spent over $1 billion on failed initiatives that do not work.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that puts us in a state where we, you know, need to, you know, like you said, take a serious look at this, take a serious look at how, you know, you got sentencing reform that's going on and all that kind of stuff. And that's why, like Lisa was saying earlier, we need an investigation.
Yes, absolutely.
So we're asking Attorney General Eric Holder to take a look at this. Again, for more information about the IRP6 case, go out to freetheirp6.org, freetheirp6.org.
Talk, news, politics, and inspiration.
Okay, joining us for our first segment as far as talking about children being sentenced to adult prisons, we have Carmen Perez. Carmen is the executive director of the Gathering for Justice. Welcome to the program, Carmen. How are you doing?
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
So, Carmen, tell us a little bit about the Gathering for Justice. We played one of your PSAs during the previous break. So for our listeners, tell us what that is about and what your involvement is with the organization.
So we were founded in 2005 by Harry Belafonte after he witnessed a 5-year-old girl by the name of Jaisha Scott being handcuffed, and her charge was that she was unruly. And so after him witnessing that footage on the screen of his TV, well, after he had given a lecture, he ended up calling upon Connie Rice from that Advancement Project and asking her if this was an isolated incident. And it happened so that it wasn't an isolated incident. And so after that, he really felt compelled to calling together his peers from the civil rights movement to have a conversation on the state of child incarceration and what had all the civil rights that they had fought for, what had they left for our children. And so after convening his peers, he realized that a lot of his peers had been really removed from the work and were now in academia. And so he then called upon the youth. And that's when I was brought in close to 10 years ago, as a youth advocate. And I have been with the organization from inception. I was an executive committee member, and I traveled across the country with Mr. Belafonte and other delegations, just learning about the issues that impact our communities, particularly with poverty and incarceration. And so we went from Epps, Alabama, and really looking at the issue that African Americans face in this country, all the way to Santa Cruz, and did like cultural exchanges and listening sessions where we learned about the Chicano struggle and gangs and the overpopulation of black and brown youth in the system. And then we went over to the Onondaga Nation and learned about the struggle of our brothers and our indigenous brothers and sisters. And then we went to Appalachia with the poor white community and really learned that, you know, this incarceration impacts all communities. And so from there, we had a national convention in 2007 where we adopted nonviolence under the methodology of Dr. King as a foundation to organizing. And so currently, as a PSA, play for you all is we are building a three-day conference called Growing Up Lockdown. And the way in which we got the name is that Growing Up Lockdown is really a state of mind. It doesn't just have to be physical. The way in which we portray young people in the media as super predators, or, you know, back in the day I was telling the story of when my mother used to say, you need to go help an elder, you know, with her bags. And now we've instilled so much fear in our communities that, you know, no longer are we comfortable with young people being around us. And so for us, it's really about bringing together direct service providers, policymakers, those that are impacted by incarceration, like families and youth, as well as youth who have never been impacted by incarceration but do live in a community that is being surveillanced or stop and frisk, to have a robust conversation on how we can develop solutions as a community and present them to our new administration here in New York City, Mayor de Blasio and Governor Cuomo. And so we're going to be convening for 3 days. We also are incorporating culture. So our conference is being opened up by Talib Kweli, and we have an evening concert with major hip-hop artists that are currently working with our program. We run a program in the Detention Center with Immortal Technique, who's a conscious hip-hop artist. And we also incorporate nonviolence trainings, and so we will have nonviolence training for our young people at the conference. As well as different workshop tracks. But we start from a national landscape, looking at what's going on with youth in America. Currently, right now, we have 3,000 young people sentenced to life without the possibility of parole. We have about 250,000 youth annually that are prosecuted as adults. And so we really need to start looking at what we're doing with our children, because young people do not belong in the system with adults. And New York State, as well as North Carolina, are one of two states in the U.S. that try youth as adults. And so we're really wanting to come together with solutions and provide a blueprint for our city on how to reform the juvenile justice system here.
And, you know, I pulled a report earlier today from the National Council on Juvenile and Family Court Judges, and it's talking about, you know, school pathways to juvenile justice system. And, you know, it's sort of a practical guide, if you will, for how to do some things or how to correct some of the things that have happened in the past. And as I was reading through it, I mean, it made total sense, and maybe you can elaborate on this, not as a representative of the National Council, obviously, but just on the subject matter of how, you know, when I was growing up, you got in trouble, you got sent to the principal's office. Then if you got sent to the principal's office too many times, you got suspended, you went home for a couple of days, but then you came back to school. But this talks about how the system, you know, changed and how law impacted it. From the standpoint of, it went from being sent to the principal's office to being sent home to then being incarcerated and under the zero tolerance policies and the effects that is having. I mean, like you were saying, your mother used to say, hey, go help an elderly person with their bags. Well, the same thing, you know, using the saying that it takes a village. If you got out of line anywhere in your neighborhood, any one of the neighbors had the liberty to call you and check. Well, now neighbors are afraid to do that because they may get a piece put in their face, or may even get, you know, some sort of form of abuse. Whether that's real or not, the perception is there.
Right. And so what you're really talking about is the school-to-prison pipeline, and you are exactly on point. Back in the day when we were growing up, is, you know, we used to be sent to the counselor's office. Our parents would come pick us up, and they would discipline us. And now we have police officers that are disguised as resource officers in our schools. And so no longer are young people sent to the counselor's office. They're now being cited or immediately arrested on campus and sent to the detention center. And those were some of the trends that we saw in Santa Cruz County. I worked at the probation department in Santa Cruz, California, and one of the largest schools our biggest citations were coming from the schools, and it was particularly a school that had a majority Latino population. And so it was because that school had a resource officer, yet the Caucasian schools didn't have resource officers. So we didn't see a lot of referrals coming from the schools that had Caucasian kids in them. And so we see that across the board, is that our young people are being targeted. And also, the trends that we have also seen, I just went to a conference here in New York City at John Jay College, and it's not that we are seeing an increase in crime, is what we are seeing are harsher policies. So young people are being arrested at larger rates. So just to give you an idea, the number of children arrested each day in America is 4,028. That's one every 21 seconds. That each wasn't happening day. During our time.
Each day.
Wow.
I mean, you know, when I was growing up, there could be a knockdown, drag-out fight in the park, and half the school turned out to see the fight, and cops never showed up.
Exactly.
You let that happen today, and
they'll call it a gang-related something, and they'll have 300 kids locked up in jail.
Wow, Carmen, we got to take a quick break. We got to take a quick break, but we will be back with Carmen Perez, the executive director of the Gathering for Justice. This is a Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. This evening, we're talking about children being sentenced to adult prisons. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.
Join a Just Cause in the fight against wrongful convictions, judicial injustice, misconduct, and corruption. Contact us at 855-529-4252 or at www.a-justcause.com.
Our children are literally eating themselves to death.
Many experts predict that this may be the first generation of children that doesn't live as long as their parents because of the problem of obesity.
A quarter of American children don't exercise regularly. The average school-age child watches 4 to 6 hours of TV every day, bombarded by commercials for fast food and junk.
How you make these kinds of lifestyle changes in your kids is to make them yourself.
Make the effort. Fight childhood obesity. A message from the Government of Canada.
Odds of becoming an astronaut, 1 in 13,200,000. Odds of being struck by lightning, 1 in 576,000. Odds of dating a supermodel, 1 in 88,000. Odds of bowling a perfect game, 1 in 11,500. Odds of being trapped in an elevator, 1 in 24,528. Odds of catching a ball at a major league game, 1 in 563. Odds of an injury from shaving, 1 in 6,585. Odds of tripping while texting, 1 in 10. Odds of getting cancer in your lifetime, 1 in 2 men, 1 in 3 women.
It's up to us
to change the odds for our generation.
For the ones we love.
For our future.
If you don't like the odds, stand up. Stand up to cancer.
They'll see you before you see them. Cops are cracking down on drinking and driving. Drive sober or get pulled over.
You are listening to AJK Radio.
Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. Joining us this evening is Carmen Perez, the executive director of the Gathering for Justice. And our subject that we're talking about this evening is children being sentenced to adult prisons. Again, welcome to the program, Carmen. Let's go to the phones real quick, Carmen. We have a caller that would like to make a comment or has a question. Cliff.
Yes, we have Cheryl in California. You have a comment?
Yeah, you know, prosecutors are just getting away with misconduct all the time. My son was convicted for a murder he didn't commit. He won his appeal. And with one witness on the stand, absolutely no evidence. So once he was released, though, they took him straight back to jail, and they're trying to retry him for the same crime. They still don't have no evidence, and they still have the same one person who couldn't even identify him. She sat in front of his picture for 3 hours and couldn't identify him right after the crime happened. And yet they convicted him the first time. And they still don't have, it's still the same thing. They don't have no evidence. He won his appeal, got out of prison, and yet they're still they're taking him back and trying to retry him again for the same crime.
And how old is your son?
He's already served 6 years in prison. He right now is 29.
Okay, thank you for the comment, Cheryl. Lamont, you wanted to speak to that?
Well, yeah, that actually, and again, it doesn't take away from the caller's frustration. They have the right to, and that's a definite hiccup, if you will, and more than that in the system that. If my opinion is, because I was exonerated, the Court of Appeals overturned my conviction, but I had to go back through a new trial. I was sent back to county jail with an option to bond out, and the whole process basically started over. So usually in an appeal case, if a case is overturned, the language is overturn and remand for new trial, but you do have the opportunity to bond out. And you know what? Prosecutors can know very well that they don't have a case, but will retry you again. They did the same thing to me. And actually, my bond initially was $10,000 in the first case, the first trial that I went through. When I came back, after the court says prosecutorial misconduct was involved here, they were saying basically they don't even believe a crime occurred because it didn't. When the prosecutor got before the judge, she asked for a $100,000 bond versus the $10,000 that is the standard rate in a case like mine. The judge cut it down to $50,000, but at that point, you know, they make it where you can't reach the bond, so you got to sit another. After me myself personally sitting 7 years in prison, I'm going to have to sit another 4 months as I wait to go through another trial. And yeah. So I do agree with the caller. I just wanted to clarify that that is protocol.
I mean, that is sick. It's like, okay, now that it's been proven that you're innocent, now we want your bond to be 10 times more than what it was before.
Because they're irritated that you beat them, basically.
So, Carmen, do you hear this type of story often in the paths that you walk?
Yes. We definitely hear it often. I mean, currently right now working with youth that are in detention, they all have the same story. And unfortunately, all the young people that we work with are black and brown kids who, you know, certainly feel they have been racially profiled. And so they're constantly, those stories are everywhere. You know, you hear them often from mothers, you hear them from the young people themselves, you hear that them from the men and the women that are incarcerated or are recently out. That's common, and there is no accountability that we have put on our system. I heard you guys talking earlier, we incentivize failing systems. If this was a business and if it was going down, we wouldn't reinvest in it. We would create completely something different. But we're constantly trying to fix the problem, which isn't fixable in this type of institution. And so, yes, you constantly hear mothers saying that their children have been wrongfully convicted, that they're being retried for the same offense. I mean, currently right now we're dealing with that here in New York City with Central Park 5. And so it's common. It's very common. And it's unfortunate.
Now, as far as the, and we talk about the black and Latino and disadvantaged youth, when you look at the disparity in sentencing between them and the Caucasian community, what kind of numbers are we looking at there?
We're looking at anywhere from, you know, I'm looking at statewide felony drug arrest, right, by ethnicity, and you have 35% black, you have 44% Hispanic, and 19% white. You'll have 42% black, 42% Hispanic, and 15% white. And so there's a major racial disparity. You see that in confinement as well. So it's significant. It's significant numbers.
Go ahead. Finish your thought.
We have the statistics, we know of certain institutions, like in California, there's the Burns Institute that works on reducing racial disparities, and there's the Vera Institute here in New York that works on, institutional innovation. But there really is no data that allows us to hold these systems accountable as to why. And it's also policing, right? So we have stop and frisk that allows officers to stop and frisk these individuals who they make assumptions have a gun, which are predominantly black and Latino youth. So we also have to change the way in which we police our community.
How do you... I'm sorry, go ahead, Lisa. That one just got me. I presume you have a gun. Why? Well, you look Latino or you look black, you must be packing.
It's the training. It's definitely the training. There's just so many layers to it. And I think one of the things that we know from media is that we've instilled fear in communities and in regards to, black men and brown men who are walking down the street. We've instilled in our communities that these men are going to harm us. And it has a lot to do with, the training of police. And you were talking about the school-to-prison pipeline earlier. A lot of resource officers who are, actually police officers are in these schools where there is, that are disenfranchised communities. That don't have much resources, but they have the resources in order to put a police officer in that school. So it has a lot to do with policing.
And Carmen, I have a question for you. What would be the basis of a child who commits a nonviolent crime being sent to an adult prison?
Here in New York State, if you're 16, you're automatically sent to an adult prison. In North Carolina, you're automatically sent, whether it's a nonviolent crime or not. There was a young person in our detention center who got into an altercation with another young person. Because he is 16, he was rearrested and then sent to Rikers. So there's various factors, but for the most part, in states like New York and North Carolina, it's just a matter of your age. The young gentleman, Duck, who was driving a vehicle, and the person in his car ended up shooting outside, put about 8 bullets into a building. Duck got 6 to 8 life sentences for that, just for being in the vehicle and driving the car. And so he was sent to an adult prison. So there are various factors. You don't necessarily have to be the person committing or engaging in the crime. Sometimes you're just there as an accomplice. And so it's really up to the district attorney to decide whether or not they're going to do a direct file, and that determines whether or not the youth will be placed in an adult facility and go through the adult process. And I know, particularly in California, we shut down several of the juvenile prisons. We put a moratorium on the juvenile prison system, but what we did see was an increase from the district attorney's office to do direct files on youth. So young people were no longer being sentenced to a juvenile prison. They were now being sentenced to adult prison. And, you know, there's a lot of harm factors when young people are sent to adult prison. They are susceptible to, you know, being preyed on sexually and violently. And so we see that across the board. We see that here in Rikers. Currently, there's a report on the conditions of what's been happening to youth at Rikers. And so young people don't belong in adult prisons. We should definitely think about removing them all from these places that they don't belong in, and try to reduce a lot of the harm that's happening to them.
Now, Carmen, I have a question. This is Lamont here again. I talked to a gentleman who was incarcerated during my wrongful incarceration, who came directly from Rikers Island. And this is what has me at this moment nauseous, if you will, because of the conditions that he explained to me that go on at Rikers, San Quentin in California. I mean, you know, prisons in Chicago. You're talking about, I mean, you're putting it lightly when you say these youth are subject and they are prey. That is an understatement. And it is a tragedy. And something has to be done in these states. I mean, Rikers is a battlefield. This gentleman told me that there people die in Rikers. He saw people die his entire time that he was there. You fight for your life every single day. And you put a 16-year-old kid, a 16-year-old kid in there. He is a kid. I've seen in the prisons here in Colorado, the prisons that I've actually stayed at, unfortunately, during my wrongful conviction, grown men nervous, uneasy, let alone a 16. That is what you call inhumane and cruel. And something has to be done about that. I salute what you're doing and the fight that you're doing with this, but the stories that I heard out of Texas prisons, Chicago, and Rikers and Sing Sing in New York are, you probably don't even discuss that on the air. That's how graphic and horrific those things that go on there. So
it's gruesome. It's gruesome. You know, we have about 10,000 children that are housed in adult jails and prisons on any given day in America. And children are five times more likely to be sexually assaulted in adult prisons than in juvenile facilities and face a larger risk of suicide. And, you know, in Connecticut, recently there was a suicide in an adult facility and by a juvenile, and the judge is the one that put a stop to 16-year-olds. He raised the age of sentencing 16-year-olds in adult prisons. And that's, unfortunately, I have to take that. It's going to take something drastic. We currently, right now, Rikers is under investigation because of those conditions, because of what you're saying, and it is too gruesome to talk about in the air. And we're not necessarily shedding enough light on what's happening in these adult prisons to these young people. It's horrendous. It's inhumane, and we need to put a stop to it. Certainly.
And, Carmen, we're going to have to go to a break here in a moment, but before we do that, let's bring Mark Clements on and have him join in on this conversation. Mark has been on the program before. He is currently working with the Northwestern Center for Wrongful Convictions in Illinois. And welcome to the program, Mark. You were actually, you know, 16 when you were wrongly convicted.
Yes, I was 16 years of age, sent to prison. I was a juvenile offender, at least offended, and sent to a Illinois prison. And as the gentleman did describe our system, it is just that gross. And the conditions must change how juveniles are treated in exchange with adult defendants. No way in the world should juvenile defendants be mixed into a much aggressive prison population unless you are intentionally throwing these kids in the midst of wolves to be victimized by older individuals. So, you know, that's the way that I view it. And, you know, sentencing juveniles to prison is heavily one-sided in race. It's heavily one-sided in, I would say, the poverty of these kids. Most of these kids come from drug or alcoholic backgrounds in which their families basically was abusive to them. And these things occur. And it is time for states like Pennsylvania and Michigan, as well as Illinois, New York, to wake up and to line its decisions with the Miller decision that came out 2 years ago, which affords for rehabilitation and opportunity for all youth in America.
And Mark, you know, that's an excellent segue. Appreciate it. Again, joining us this evening, Mark Clements is with the Northwestern Center for Wrongful Convictions in Illinois. Mark was wrongly convicted at the age of 16. He's one of our guests this evening. Also, Carmen Perez, the executive director of the Gathering for Justice. If you both can stick with us as we take a quick break. But when we come back, Mark, you bring a couple of good issues to the table. And I want you to think about it, Carmen, as well. And if you both can join in on the conversation, let's talk about the impact of socioeconomic status or socioeconomic disadvantages and how it plays into this problem of youth incarceration. So this is A Just Cause, Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. Our phone number, 347-838-8976, 347-838-8976. Join us on the other side of the break with Carmen Perez and Mark Clements, our guests this evening. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.
The true artistry of Harry Belafonte.
There's a lot of people out here who are really pissed off.
Harry gave us a piece of his fire. It gave us all strength.
We are angry. We're upset.
Harry motivated Martin because he is a man who didn't have to get involved and who did.
We look around for some comfort and we don't find any.
I remember once when he said, from the time I get up, the time I go to sleep, I seek out the injustice that's done to humankind.
What do we want?
Peace!
What do we want?
Now! He was always like that. He was always, let's do something.
Harry did this over and over and over and over again.
He took all our struggles and made them his own.
We can't be shut up no more.
Talk about movement building.
We gotta stand up.
Power. We're gonna organize even harder. We're gonna knock on some more doors, talk to some more policymakers.
Don't give up, don't give up. Don't give in, don't give in.
I try to envision playing out the rest of my life almost exclusively devoted to reflection. But is there too much in the world to be done?
Children have been consistently incarcerated, have been consistently handcuffed. What is going on here?
Together in one place, September 24th through 26th at the New School. Harry Belafonte, Talib Kweli, Immortal Technique, Aja Monet, Cornell West, Jusiri X, Brian Stevenson, Central Park 5, Sophia Elijah, George Gresham, Linda Sarsour, and hundreds of others.
What is going on here? What have we come to?
Growing Up Lockdown, Juvenile Justice Conference, September 24th through 26th at the New School. Join the movement to end child incarceration. For more information, go to gatheringforjustice.org.
I'm a mother.
I'm a father.
I'm a sister.
a registered nurse.
I serve my country in the United States military.
I'm your neighbor.
I sit next to you at church.
And my child was
arrested,
held in custody, questioned without my knowledge,
exposed to violence,
witnessed to rape,
placed in solitary confinement,
unable to call or see me,
shackled to a wall,
beaten,
sentenced as an adult at age 17,
sentenced as an adult at age 16,
sentenced as an adult at age 15.
We felt lost,
isolated,
ostracized, misjudged,
terrified,
and in the absence of all hope, my child took his own life. And then I found the Alliance for Youth Justice. They gave me the support and resources to get through one of the most difficult times in my life.
Now I know I'm not alone.
And neither are you.
Now we have a voice.
Now we have power.
In numbers.
In numbers.
In numbers.
We can make a difference.
Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice this evening. We're talking about children being sentenced to adult prisons. Joining us is Carmen Perez, the executive director of the Gathering for Justice, as well as Mark Clements. He was wrongfully convicted at the age of 16, and now he is working with the Northwestern Center for Wrongful Convictions in Illinois. Welcome to the program, both of you.
Thank you.
So, Mark, before the break, and either one of you, I'll pose a question to you first, Mark. You were talking about it earlier as far as the socioeconomic disadvantages and how that impacts the youth incarceration or the youth crime rate, which then equates to youth incarceration. I mean, I'm looking at numbers like, you know, 79% of individuals reported witnessing violence in their homes, you know, those who've been incarcerated as far as young kids. They witnessed violence in them, in their homes themselves. Nearly half of them experienced physical abuse as well, including 79% of girls. So from your experience and the work that both of you do, and again, Mark, I'll start with you, how much do you think that plays a role in the problems that we're seeing?
Well, it plays a large role because basically most of the children that are sentenced to natural life are children that are treated as throwaways. You know, we may look at it in a humane manner by saying, well, that little Timmy committed a crime, but where does redemption come in at? Where does reform, what has happened to rehabilitation? And if we cannot rehabilitate the youngest defendants that enter into our criminal justice system, then we have a problem. Not to forget that most of these young kids go through the criminal justice system and is not able to aid their attorneys. As a result, these kids are found guilty. Statistics have shown that a large percentage of them were manipulated by the system so that the system could draw convictions and to incarcerate these kids, with some of them, as well as myself, being innocent and sent to prison. I feel that it is needed for a parole system within our prison systems to give men and women that may be totally innocent of crimes another avenue so that the system could hopefully get it right before 28 years of incarceration.
Carmen Perez.
Well, just to add to what he's saying, you know, I feel there's a major impact on, you know, not only the young people, but the family. You have family instability. You have a lack of quality education. Young people aren't necessarily in these communities that are impoverished. You have a lack of employment. So unemployment rates are sky high. Major youth violence, domestic violence, And so I think one of the things that you know, for me, just seeing in the community I grew up in is, you know, my parents were working and you know, they were trying to put food on the table. And I'll tell you what, the streets don't close, right? They're open 24 hours. A lot of the programs that service young people are open from 9 to 5. Well, you know, the streets are open, you know, from 5 to midnight, 5 till 2 in the morning. And so I think that one of the things that also needs to change is we need to change the way in which we deliver services. You know, young people get out of school around 2 p.m., making programming available after school until midnight. But also, what I've also seen, once young people get caught up in the system, very similar to what Mr. Clement said, is that they don't have proper representation. A lot of young people, because they don't have the financial resources, nor do their families, don't receive the representation that they need. So they end up taking a plea. And will be violated for very minor offenses. You know, because parents are working, they're not able to provide the support and the supervision that young people need, or the transportation that young people need to go see their probation officers or their parole officers. It creates a cycle that's never ending. And in order for that cycle to end, something needs to shift, and it has a lot to do with socioeconomic status.
And I was reading the National Council of Juvenile and Family Court Judges. They, you know, put out this report on school pathway to juvenile justice system. And one of the excerpts from that says the U.S. Department of Education's Office for Civil Rights reports that African-American students are more than 3.5 times more likely to be suspended or expelled than their white peers. They said evidence suggests that the subjective nature of zero tolerance policies leads to differential treatment of minority students. White students are more likely to be punished for guns, weapons, and drugs violations, whereas African-American students are more likely to be reprimanded for appearing to be threatening or being disrespectful. And, you know, I know that when I was coming up, you know, I'm not going to say I was the perfect juvenile, very far from it. I ended up, you know, when I got in trouble, like Sam said, you know, you get in trouble at school. In my situation, you go to the counselor several times. They try to talk you into doing what's right. If the counselor can't deal with you, then you go to the principal. The principal tries to get you, with the help of your parents, to, you know, make a change. They try to put you in sports programs. They try to, you know, say, well, hey, maybe one of your classes or a classmate is the problem. Maybe one of your classes is something you don't want to adhere to. Well, I ended up going to what, you know, we used to call reform school. And reform school is basically your last chance to say, okay, you either reform here or you're going to be expelled from school. And one of the things in reform school, they say if you get in a fight there, the police are automatically called. So at school, they try to help you. You know, you keep being bad. Then you go to reform school. Then they say if you get in a fight here, the teachers already are. And, you know, it's more to deter you that if you get in a fight, we're going to call the police. And like you said, Carmen, you know, now just in schools, the police are already there. But I said that to say that. And I read that piece of that article because when I went to reform school, it was all black and brown kids. There may have been one white kid here or there, you know, and we got there by continually fighting, you know, maybe threatening somebody, maybe being at school, getting high, getting drunk, doing something that we had no business doing. But I know that it wasn't just the black and Latino kids that were the ones that were doing these things at school, because there were white kids that, hey, you know, most of the time the white guy was the one who sold us a bag of weed.
Mm-hmm.
But you never saw them at reform school, and you definitely, their parents were more likely to be called and them taken and, you know, getting real counseling, you know, going to a psychiatrist or something like that. With us, it was, hey, you know, send them to reform school, and then the police come. Nowadays, it's just if you're threatening, you know, hands up, you get shot, just like
Mike Brown.
Yeah, Mike Brown. Hands up, you get shot 6 times. You know, Trayvon Martin, you're walking down the street, you got on a hoodie, you're not a white kid, you must not belong in this neighborhood. Hey, I want to be neighborhood watch, so I got to shoot you.
clip. I think we have a caller. Let's bring the caller on real quick.
Okay, we have a caller coming in. You are on the air.
Hi, this is Sophia Elijah. How are you?
Hi, Sophia.
Surprise caller for you, Carmen.
Yeah, conversation is really good.
So, Sophia, thanks for joining the program. We understand that you're at another event right now. You're going to be supporting the event that's coming up, Growing Up Lockdown, in the next couple of weeks.
That's correct. Yes, I'll be moderating one of the panels that will include Mr. Delafonte. I'm really, really looking forward to it.
Awesome.
We'll be able to draw some attention to what's happening, in particular in the youth justice system.
So, Carmen, I take it that you and Sophia have been working together for a while?
Yes. Sophia is an amazing femtor who is doing phenomenal work with her organization here in New York City and inside prisons. And just a lot of her staff are people who I collaborate with. And one of her staff members, Angelo Pinto, is on our Justice League, who is helping build the three-day conference with us. So Sophia's amazing, so I'm really excited she called in, and she's going to be moderating A Radical Shift in the 21st Century, which is a panel that has Dr. Cornel West, Mr. Belafonte, Glenn Martin, and others. Yes.
All right. Well, I'm sure that's going to be a great event. So, again, thank you for calling in, Sophia. I know that you're at another event, so we're not going to hold you. Did you have any closing words before we cut you loose?
Everybody needs to be at this event and get involved in this work.
All right. Okay. Well, thanks for calling in.
Thank you. Take care. Good work.
So, Mark, let's get you back in on this conversation here. I know that, you know, when we're talking about the wake, let me kind of turn it just a little bit as far as something that happened to you. With the torture and the coerced or forced conversation that led to a coerced confession, I believe. Is that correct?
Oh, yes. It was a confession which was obtained by way of torture by Chicago police officers that worked under the command of John Burge, who is previously incarcerated, however, will be released this October the 5th. And one point that I wanted to touch on is let's not forget that the higher beings that play a role in our criminal justice system does it to profit and for racial reasons. We are still individuals in this country that are still subject to the penalty of white privilege. And that is one thing that we must understand. Many people will believe or would like for people to believe that white privilege no longer exists. I beg to differ. And that is how some of these kids are able to get away with so much as being Caucasians compared to African Americans. African Americans are stereotyped as the violent individuals. And what ends up happening is due to the fact that these kids are demonized by really people spreading rumors that all African Americans are so violent, they take the harshest penalties against African American kids. And that is one thing that we must look at. Will a kid from the upper richest parts of New York be treated like a kid that was born in the slums of the Bronx? No. And I have seen it with my own two eyes where that some white children were charged with very serious crimes and were able to walk out of the courtroom because they were not bonded over to be tried as adults.
So we must still look at the fact that our system is about making money, and unfortunately, many of them are still playing the race card, and that plays a lot with the criminal justice system now today.
Absolutely. I mean, we did a segment last week on, you know, basically the prison enterprise and how many millions of dollars that or billions that it makes per year, and the multi-billion-dollar corporations that fund it, you know, invest in the prison system. And it is just like you say, it's an enterprise, and it's all about making money. And obviously, if you can get a 16-year-old, give him a life sentence, say, hey, you know, we basically have a free worker, a slave, for, you know, the next 60, 70 years. And so, you know, we also looked at, you know, the comparison on some of the victims to to basically the perpetrators. And, you know, here in Denver, Colorado, at the Aurora Theater, they had the Aurora Theater shooter, and they referred to him as a genius who had gone wrong. And then they referred to Michael Brown, who was a black victim, as he had a clouded background. And so they do all these disparities, not just understand that it's most minorities. I mean, it's especially like Carmen uses the phrase, you know, black and brown. If you're black and brown, then you're going to be lumped into the pile of you must be a criminal if the police had to engage you. I mean, just like the statement she made before, how do you say that I assume you have a gun if you're walking down the street? What, you'd assume I have a gun because I'm walking down the street because I'm not a white kid? I mean, I was looking at a video where this white guy, he's probably a middle-aged, you know, maybe 50. He's walking down the street with an AR-15, that's an assault rifle. And the police are basically negotiating with him, telling, sir, can you put the weapon down? And he's telling him, I got the right to walk around, you know, it's my Second Amendment right. I got the right to walk around with a firearm. And they're telling him, yeah, we understand this. Do you have, what's your name? He won't tell him his name. He won't give him any ID. All he's telling them is, do not bother me. I have the right as a citizen. When you see, you try that as a non-white citizen, you walk down the street with an AR-15, they're going to say, we got a gang member out here. He's from a black gang. He's from a Latino gang. He's walking down the street with an assault rifle. Guarantee you there won't be five police officers having a conversation with you. You'll get shot at least five times. They will put you down and say you were threatening the community. And that is the disparity, especially among, you know, among our kids. I got a 13-year-old son, and I would hate for the cops just because he's a black kid that, hey, you must have a weapon. You must be going down the street. And most of the times now, you'll have a kid that if they get, if the police come to them and start talking to everybody, the first thing they do is say, okay, I don't know what to do in this situation. They're going to reach in their phone, in their pocket, to grab their phone, say, I better call somebody. I need to call my parent. I would hate for my son to be walking down the street, the police start confronting him, and he reach into his pocket to say, I'm going to call my parents to see what I'm going to do, and he ends up shot. But that is what happens, because they automatically assume if you're a black kid, if you're a brown kid, and you're walking in a neighborhood that it doesn't look like you belong there, you're black or you're Latino, you don't live in this neighborhood, we assume, so you must be here to rob somebody, you must be here to hurt somebody, and that's how we end up with our teenagers dead.
Mm-hmm.
By the hands of police officers, mostly, may I say.
Mm-hmm. So, Carmen, go ahead, Carmen.
There's something that was said earlier about just the privatization of prisons, and we are seeing a large amount of prisons becoming private, and the people that profit from those prisons are major companies, but also the politicians, because you have these company CEOs in bed with politicians that provide money to them. But there was a major scandal that happened in Pennsylvania, in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, where two judges were accused of and found guilty of accepting money from two builders of two private prisons for juveniles. And the documentary that released the scandal that is called Kids for Cash. And so we are seeing an increase of incarceration, particularly, like I've said before, in the Black and Latino community, but the people that are actually making money off of you know, housing Black and Latino folks are major investors that are investing in private prisons. And so it's happening in all over the country. There's a really great book on it called Prisons for Profit. That shows how these companies will then turn around and kick back money to politicians for re-election. And these politicians will then put a bid to actually have private prisons in their states. So it's a major scandal, and it's unfortunate. And we need to do more around divestment in private prisons and in these companies as well.
And on the subject of, you know, going back to the school situation, I know, Carmen, you were talking about this a little bit earlier, and I'm looking at a statistic that was put out by the Civil Rights Data Collection, and just as a snapshot, you know, looking at Los Angeles, and this stat comes from around the 2009 time frame, but I'm sure it's not much different, and it says that the Los Angeles Unified School District reported the following numbers of out-of-school suspension: 62% Hispanic students, 33% Black students, 3% white, and 2% Asian. And that same school district, reported that their expulsions were at 67% of Hispanic students, and 5% of Black students were, and they were not offered educational services. And so that goes back to what you were saying. It's like, you know, the resources are there for a, quote, resource officer, but the resources, the financial resources, are not there to give them some sort of after-school program, something that's going to keep them occupied. You know, they're doing away with ban and, you know, some of the athletics. And then the socioeconomic impact, even if it does, you know, like Cliff was saying, you know, your parents try to put you in sports and so forth. Now sports, where it used to be paid for by the school system, and I'm going back, you know, way back, but it used to be paid for by the school system. Now, if you cannot afford, a lot of people cannot afford to even play sports because there's so many fees associated with it. The insurance that you have to pay, the athletic fees that you have to pay, that kind of stuff is no longer subsidized by the school systems. So kids that would play sports to stay out of trouble don't even have that luxury. I was having this conversation with a gentleman just this past Saturday, and he is a coach at the high school level here in Colorado Springs. And we were talking about kids from troubled neighborhoods because he coaches a school in a troubled neighborhood. And he was saying, you know, there's a fine line between, you know, really lowering the hammer on a kid and totally driving them away from the team versus, you know, kind of handling them a little bit with kid gloves, at least, you know, for 3 hours a day, you got them on the field.
Right.
And you know where they are, you know what they're doing, and they're not out trying to rob somebody.
That's right. And that's what my coach told me.
It's a big dilemma.
You know, when I got in trouble, I was always fighting in school. And the coach saw me in the principal's office. He said, you know what, Stuart? Look, you want to hit somebody, I can put you in pads. That is the object of the game. Go out there and hit somebody as hard as you want to. And that, you know, it didn't completely deter me. It helped me a lot. But I ended up breaking my ankle. And then when I couldn't play football, I felt like, hey, I didn't have anything to go back to school for. I didn't have a reason to keep my grades above a C. I didn't have a reason to show up in class because football is what helped me to stay out of trouble. After school, instead of saying, okay, I'm going to go hang out with my friends in the street, I would go to football practice for 3.5 hours. So it would be like, 7, 8 o'clock by the time I got home. I was tired. I would go home, eat, and then go to bed. It deterred me from being in trouble. But, I mean, you look at these things. I just got a video from one of our research team, and it shows this mother, a black mother, with her three children in the car, 9, 10, and 8
right.
years old. And the when you look at what the description of, you know, what the cops were looking for was a tan or beige Toyota. This woman is driving a red, dark red, maroon Nissan Maxima. They've got her and her kids getting out of the car, coming back to the car with their hands up. They said they're looking for four black males in a tan or beige Toyota. Here they stop a mother and her three kids. And she's saying you guys are going to terrify my kids. What are you doing? What are you even stopping me for? The kids are in the car crying. But that is just a thing. The cops get a report that, hey, we're looking for some black people. It doesn't matter. Any black person will do. What vehicle are they in? Hey, doesn't matter. Just find the nearest vehicle with some dark skinned people and pull them over, even if there's 8 year old kids in the car. And it's ridiculous because we have to teach our kids. This little boy is walking with his hands up. We have to teach our children, when you see the cops, make sure to put your hands up, because if you don't, they will come up with some reason for saying that they had the right to shoot you. And that it is sick. And this is what is coming, that is coming to with our kids. And to send them to prison for, you know, in a lot of cases like you, Mark, that didn't even do anything. We had Khalif Browder's attorney on, Paul Prestia, who we went to Rikers at 16, totally innocent, tried to kill himself three times because of what was going on in there. And it's sick, but this is what our country has come to, and we need to all stand up and ensure that that we go back toward, you know, make some paces toward what's right. This is ridiculous.
Carmen and Mark, if you can, if we can impose upon you just a few more minutes, let's take a quick break, and then we'll come back and get some closing thoughts from you. We have Carmen Perez, the executive director of the Gathering for Justice, and then also Mark Clements, who was wrongfully convicted at the age of 16, who is now with the Northwestern Center for Wrongful Convictions in Illinois. This evening we're talking about children being sentenced to adult prisons. So don't go anywhere. This is a Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. We'll be right back.
I'm a mother.
I'm a father.
I'm a sister.
A registered nurse.
I serve my country in the United States military.
I'm your neighbor.
I sit next to you at church.
And my child was
arrested,
held in custody,
questioned without my knowledge,
exposed to violence,
witnessed to rape,
placed in solitary confinement,
unable to call or see me,
shackled to a wall,
beaten,
sentenced as an adult at age 17,
sentenced as an adult at age 16,
sentenced as an adult at age 15.
We felt lost,
isolated,
ostracized,
misjudged,
terrified.
And in the absence of all hope, my child took his own life.
And then I found the Alliance for Youth Justice.
They gave me the support and resources to get through one of the most difficult times in my life.
Now I know I'm not alone.
And neither are you.
Now we have a voice.
Now
we have power.
In numbers.
In numbers.
In numbers.
We can make a difference.
There are approximately 2 million children in the juvenile and criminal justice system in this country. These are the faces of those families. If you are the family member of a child who has been in the justice system, or if you are someone who supports this movement and is ready to make a difference, visit the Campaign for Youth Justice at www.campaignforyouthjustice.org.
Each week, a Just Cause Coast to Coast shares compelling stories about judicial injustice. But AJC doesn't leave it there. AJC Radio presents top guests from around the country who are advocates, activists, attorneys, and judges who provide insight into current events and the law. If you believe in what AJC is doing, we ask that you make a donation of any amount. Your kindness will be greatly appreciated. Go to www.a-justcause.com and click on the donate button. Please note, A Just Cause is currently waiting on recertification by the IRS of our 501c3 status, so at this time we ask that you donate based on your belief in the cause. please consult your tax advisor for tax questions. We value you as loyal listeners and will continue to bring programming that provides education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. Thank you for your consideration.
Hi, I'm an actor, and that qualifies me to talk to you about social issues. And even though my opinion is controversial, I believe that racism is wrong. Now today, what I would like you to do is take a look at your skin color and hug somebody that has a different color skin. We can stop racism together, one hug at a time. Definitely ask permission before you hug somebody. Thank you.
To hear about all the great things you can do when you grow up.
Hi, everyone. I'm Emily. I'm super excited to introduce my dad because he's my hero.
When I was little, my dad was away a lot. But I was okay with that because he was doing this really important work driving ambulances in Iraq. Now he's at home, which is great for me because I get to see him every day now. And he's still the biggest hero I know because he tells all the ambulances and the fire engines where to go and rescue people when there's an emergency. I'm so proud of him. He's awesome. He's my dad.
If your service-connected disability prevents you from continuing in your civilian career, Voc Rehab offers counseling, training with a living allowance, education, and other services to help prepare you for your next mission.
The opinions and views expressed by guests and callers on A Just Cause Coast to Coast do not necessarily reflect those of A Just Cause or A Just Cause Coast to Coast.
I guess I got to turn my mic on, right? A Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. I'm Sam Thurman, along with Lisa Stewart, Cliff Stewart, and our special contributing analyst, Exoneree Lamont Banks, joining us this evening. Carmen Perez, Executive Director of the Gathering for Justice, and Mark Clements with the Northwestern Center for Wrongful Convictions in Illinois. So, Mark, what are some of the things that Northwestern Center for Wrongful Convictions, what are they doing now, and what are you doing, and what type of impact are you making with regard to the effort to reduce this problem with juvenile convictions? Did we lose Mark?
You still with us, Mark?
All right. Well, while Mark is working his way back, maybe he stepped away for a moment. But, Carmen, as far as the event that's coming up for the Gathering for Justice, Growing Up Lockdown, give us some of the highlights, some of the key points that's going to be happening in that event, and how folks can register for that.
Well, the 3 days begin with a kickoff performance from Talib Kweli and a keynote address from Harry Belafonte, who is the founder of our organization, and a plenary conversation on the state of juvenile justice. But the days look like this. We have media accountability in juvenile justice, the way in which young people are being portrayed in the media, and so we have panelists like Central Park Five, as well as Jenna Six, that will be sitting along other journalists. We have workshops. We have performances from John Forte, Mortal Technique, and we have other plenaries on this radical shift of the 21st century, system accountability, as well as community solutions, so really elevating the organizations that are doing the work on the ground and providing alternatives to incarceration for our young people, but also what the role of artists are. Mr. Belafonte always talks about artists are the gatekeepers to truth, And so one of our panels is about the artist's role in advancing juvenile justice reform. And so we have several local hip-hop artists as well as other individuals that will be participating in that conversation. And then we end the evening of Friday with a major concert for our young people. So we're expecting about 400 individuals that come from all walks of life, whether you're formerly incarcerated or a family who has somebody incarcerated, a policymaker, a young person, direct service providers. But we're really excited because we're looking at really incorporating the mission of the gathering, and that's to build a national movement to end child incarceration, incorporating culture as well as nonviolence. But producing two solution papers. One would be a policy paper that will be developed during the conference. And then one is a community conversation where we'll be going to every borough and gathering people to really talk about what solutions are needed in their community. And those will be presented to our administration, Mayor de Blasio, as well as Governor Cuomo, as a blueprint on how to reform the juvenile justice system with the support of those that will participate in our conference. The way in which you could register for the conference is if you go to guild2014.eventbrite.com, or you could go to our website, which is gatheringforjustice.org, which is gatheringfor justice.org.
Okay.
So
well, good luck with that event, and that's Carmen Perez, Executive Director of the Gathering for Justice, and information, we will be posting that information also on our website at ajcradio.com. Again, ajcradio.com. So the event is growing up, locked down. So Carmen, over the next week and a half or so, we will continue to play the promos for that event leading up to it, and we hope that you guys get a really good turnout.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And thank you for having me. I really appreciate the conversation and letting us talk about the work that we do.
Thank you, Carmen.
Yes, thank you.
Have a good evening.
All right. So, bye-bye. Thank you. Bye-bye.
So, you know, and Mark, if you're back, just jump in there and holler and let us know you're back. But, you know, Cliff, I'm looking at some statistics here. And, you know, when we talk about the color of mass incarceration, and, mm-hmm. and we've talked about this before, and how one out of every three African-American males will be incarcerated in his lifetime. So, you know, you got three African-American babies in the birthing center. One out of those three is going to end up going to jail.
That's right.
And then you got one out of six Latino male men will mm-hmm. be incarcerated in their lifetime.
And this is, you know, no particular fault of their own. It's sickening that just because you were born black, just because you were born Latino, that the system already has it laid out that one in three or one in six is gonna go to jail. I mean, that makes absolutely no sense.
And you know, I was glad to hear that Carmen mentioned the fact that that they're going to have a panel on the media.
Right.
You know, we were just talking about that on our program last week, I believe, when you have the two men who were in North Carolina, I believe, who had been incarcerated for 30 years.
Yes.
Yeah.
And you know, we had that conversation about how you have people that are wrongly convicted, people of color, and when they get out, there's this big, you know, media hoopla,
mm-hmm.
This big celebration about, oh, look, this guy has spent 30 years in prison, and like you
right.
said, Cliff, last week, and this is the first time he has seen an automatic seatbelt or learned
right.
how to use a new seatbelt. That is not the type of thing that we need to be talking
right.
about.
That's not what he needs to learn. He needs to learn how to reintegrate himself into society. He needs help on how he is going to be a citizen of a new world. I mean, to go to prison in 1984, he does not understand what is out there in 2014. He's talking about 30 years later. 30 years, he has no clue on what the world holds for him. To show him how to use a seatbelt, that's well and good. He can get down the street safe in the car in case something happens. But what about the rest of his life? What about the other things that he's lost? The fact that, you know, he went in as a kid And now he comes in. I mean, he has had absolutely no life except as being incarcerated for 30 years for no particular reason. That is, I mean, you cannot fathom that. You cannot wrap your mind around what do you do now. You went in with this child's mentality. You haven't been a part of society. All you've been a part of is the prison system since you were 16-year-old.
And why doesn't the media dig into why was this person incarcerated when they were 16? What were all the ramifications or all the issues on the table? And, you know, where was the prosecutorial misconduct? Where was the judicial misconduct?
Yes.
Why are they not doing an expose on this kind of thing? And like you were saying before, the way the media portrays the youth or the way the media portrays the person who is incarcerated, you know, there is a disparity in how the African-American and the Latino is portrayed versus how the Caucasian is portrayed. Yeah. And so, Mark, I understand you're back with us.
Yes, I am back with us, and please forgive me. But briefly, what I was explaining is that the people must get involved, meaning the listeners that are listening, and we must turn this into a national fight as we even deal with the death penalty. We must turn this into a national fight and understand that we're fighting for our children, we're fighting for our grandchildren. And long as we sit back, nothing is going to occur. And very briefly, for those who would like to contact me, I can be contacted by way of Facebook, which is Mark A. Clemens, C-L-E-M-E-N-T-S, or you can just simply call me at 847-276-1382.
Okay, Mark, and again, you know, thanks for joining us on the program, and you know, we've had you on before where we went into quite a bit of detail on your story. And, you know, at the age of 16 and being wrongly convicted and that's, you know, that's the kind of thing. And I know that you have dedicated your life to helping others who've been wrongfully convicted and trying to get this trend turned around where our youth are being sent to prison in droves. And like Carmen was saying earlier, you know, just the prison industrial complex. I mean, you know, that's what we talked about tonight is just the tip of the iceberg on that. We've talked about that extensively here as well. But again, you know, Mark Clemens, thank you for joining us. We will have information posted out there on Mark as well. Mark is doing work with the Northwestern Center for Wrongful Convictions. And so thanks again, Mark. We appreciate
it. Thank you. Okay. Good night. Thank you.
Good night. So, Cliff, you know, when we talk about going back to this thing with the media and how the disparity that the way people are portrayed, that's a big issue. And so, you know, the fact that they're going to be talking about that at the growing up lockdown, I think that's a good thing. You know, one other thing, and we don't have time to really dive into it tonight, but in detail, but right alongside of where it talks about the racial disparity and the socioeconomic issues, there are statistics that show where, well, I guess it does fall into the category of the socioeconomic, where kids who spent time in foster care, you know, there are huge numbers there as well.
Yeah.
And so it all kind of goes hand in hand when you talk about disadvantaged youth, people of color, the programs that are not made available to them. And it's just one big pile of mess.
Yeah, and then, I mean, just the stereotype, just the fact that, you know, if you're black or you're Latino, I mean, that one that Carmen laid out that said the assumption that you're carrying a weapon, how did they even come up with that? How does the officer assume somebody's you must have a gun? And it's just a stereotype to say, well, if you're black or you're Latino, you got to be carrying a weapon. And you look at what society says, you know, we as people of color should be doing. You know, if you're a black teenager, you should be out committing some crime. If you're an adult, you're probably committing some crime. If you're working, you're probably an entertainer. You know, and that's pretty much it. And it is sickening because, you know, you look at the IRPC, five of them are black,
yeah,
and six are white. Gary Walker is a genius among geniuses. The other four of the black guys are mostly engineers or, you know, database architects. So you got engineers and technical architects. That is not, if you look for the stereotype of a black person, and the reason that that is not what we're seen as is because they take men like the IRP6, and when they come up with something, they say, hide that from society,
yep,
that this is what a black man can do.
Well, and you got to go to something that happened in the trial. Well, a couple of things. Andrew Alberelli, who mm-hmm. was a expert witness that the prosecution did not want to get on the stand. Mr. Alberelli is the chief principal officer of a staffing company,
right,
Remy Corporation. He was going to testify to the fact that the way IRP was conducting business was legitimate. It was consistent with the way the industry works. They did not, they being Matthew Kirsch, the assistant U.S. attorney, did not want Mr. Alberelli
right
on the stand. And Judge Arguello.
She ensured that he didn't get
absolutely
on the stand. And I talked to Andrew about that. And, you know, we need to get him on the show again because me and him had a conversation about the racial aspect of what happened in the courtroom that day. And he brought it up. He said, you know, Cliff, I don't typically go to the race card because I try to give, you know, and Andrew's, you know, he's white, but he's like, I try to give white people the benefit of the doubt that they're not racist. He said, but what happened that day in the courtroom? He said, you know what? What they did not want a white man who's successful in business
to endorse,
to get up and endorse this black-owned company and what they did as business as usual. He said because if the jury would have seen a white man endorsing them, that would have shed a whole new light and would have opened up a whole new you know, comprehension or thought process about exactly what happened and their intentions in doing business. He brought it up and we dealt with, and he was saying the way that they brought Joe on the stand as an expert witness, that okay, here's another black guy who's in the staffing industry who's known by these guys, but hey, this is just one of their black friends who want to help them out. He said they did not want the white professional, you know, successful businessman to say anything positive about these black men. And that is what it's all about. You know, we read the article earlier about ISIS in Texas and how the Silk software could, you know, help track these ISIS cells. And just another part of that article, it said, you know, this is the Lieutenant General Boykin who's speaking. He said, we've known for some time that terrorist elements have entered the U.S. through Mexico. This is nothing new. Actually, Islamic terrorists are likely planning multiple attacks in the border region, including perhaps malls and power grids, according to Major General Valley, who assures that the cells are quite sophisticated. They're well-organized and well-funded. But and my thing is, if this is what we know about these ISIS cells, why can't we not track them? Like, we know they're here. We know they're sophisticated. We know they're well-funded. We know they're going to do something, but we cannot bring the pieces all together. And why? One of the reasons, you have no technological way of tracking, of bringing all the information and tracking down these people. When the Silk software, it was customized for DHS. Sam, tell us the module they were looking for. What did they want to buy?
The confidential informant module.
$100
million. $100
million. And what would it have done?
That's greatly discounted from the $1 billion that they paid to a couple of other contractors.
Exactly. And the confidential informant module was a people tracking module.
That's all
it
was about.
That's what it was about.
And there is absolutely no coincidence that that's talked about in the 9/11 Commission report.
That's
there is
right.
Absolutely no coincidence that out of 18 modules, Department of Homeland Security asked IRP to customize that and put a federal face on it. There is absolutely no coincidence that one of the largest law enforcement agencies in the country
mm-hmm.
contacted one of the smallest corporations in the country.
That's right.
And said, hey, we heard you guys have developed something that we need to see.
Yeah.
And we need you to come to Washington, D.C. And show it to us. So
yeah.
How is it that this company gets raided and we've heard, you know, even like in NYPD when they were showing it there, the person that was there at NYPD said, I don't know why NYPD yeah. hasn't bought this. I don't know if it's because the company is small or because the executives are black. You know, you don't have to be a rocket scientist.
Yeah, you don't have to be a rocket scientist. You come to your own conclusion based off of the evidence that's on the table. Just like if you get on the road heading to, toward Denver, you head toward Denver, you keep going, you're going to hit Denver. There's no other place to go. And there's no other place to go in this except what's on the table, the evidence has.
And then the thing that happened in the courtroom, too, when you talk about racial disparity and the way that African-American defendants are treated versus yes. the way Caucasian defendants are treated. When the IRP 6, and we're talking about Gary Walker, David Banks, Dave Zappolo, Kendrick Barnes, Clinton Stewart, and Demetrius Harper, and like you said, they were all IT professionals. When they started going down the road of describing who they were, what they were about, their background, I mean, you know, Gary Walker having a presidential appointment to the Air Force Academy, David Banks, graduating top of his class as an air traffic controller in the Navy, Clint Stewart being a an NCO in the Air Force, but had top secret clearances handling top ComSec. You got Demetrius Harper, Kendrick Barnes. Both of them are kids of career military men, and then Dave Zappolo, you know, the ultimate IT professional. But when they started to convey this information to in the courtroom and to the jury. The prosecutor says, you know, your character is not on trial here.
Well, then what is?
Yeah. So you got all this stuff where people are trying to stack this against them. And anyway, we're going to be talking about more of this in shows to come. Don't miss us on Thursday evening. It's 9/11, the 13th anniversary of 9/11. And so we're actually going to be talking about that and talking more about IRP and the Case Investigative Lifecycle software, the Silk software. Keep our brothers in prayer, Gary Walker, David Banks, Dave Zappolo, Kendrick Barnes, Clinton Stewart, and Demetrius Harper. And then also regarding that missing transcript, please go out to change.org, do a search on IRP6, and sign that petition.
And we also want everybody to do your best to give a call to Eric Holder's office at 202-514-2003 or 2005 and request that he do an investigation into the IRP6 case, the missing transcript, and the Fifth Amendment violation. We need an investigation on this, and we need it now, and we need your help to do it.
That's right. We want to say thank you to our guests, to Carmen Perez and Mark Clements. We appreciate you guys coming on and spending the evening with us. It was very enlightening and touching stories. Also, to the everyone in the chat room, we appreciate all your questions and comments there as well. You need anything, go out to freetheirp6.org to get those documents that you might be looking for. Again, that's freetheirp6, the number 6.org to get that. To K&D Productions, Captain Kyle and Dustin Jackson help out the control room. They make sure that you hear what it is that we have to say. To our production support team, they give us the accurate and most up-to-date information so that we ensure that we get that to you. Most of the time, it is good. They've been doing good for quite a while now, so we appreciate that. To the truth, we know you're out there. We appreciate it.
To Attorney Gwendolyn Solomon, we want to say give a shout-out to you and for all the work that you're doing on behalf of the IRP6. Olivia, Ms. Barb, again, thanks for taking care of things as far as screening and doing a lot of the research and so forth. Also, we would ask that you go to our website at www.a-justcause.com and look for information about the Justice for All Reauthorization Act and support that. We are supporting it. It is sponsored by Senator Patrick Leahy. And then also you can catch archives of the program at ajcradio.com. Go to live365.com for 24/7 programming. And then you can also catch us on Sunday mornings at 10:30 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. Eastern Time on Progressive Radio Network. That's at prn.fm. Like us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. On behalf of Cliff Stewart, Lisa Stewart, Lamont, Sam Thurman, A Just Cause Coast to Coast, educational awareness and information about judicial injustice. Good night, America.
Good night.
Good night, all.